both in terms of responding to parents or to responding to leadership. The authority that somebody has at a critical time is the caricature or the exaggeration of it. Kind of the extreme example of this is where somebody comes home from shul every Shabbos and sits down at the Shabbos table and ridicules or derogates or pokes fun at the rabbi's divrei Torah. The attitude in the home, in the many little ways that come up during the course of the week, the dismissal of whatever the rabbinic authority is, or the attitude towards the gedolia Torah, they're not really gedolia or whatever. So years pass, and now the children are grown, and there's a crisis. One of the children doing something they're not supposed to. And so the parent is at a total loss, and they do understand that one of the people that conventionally should have some kind of influence would be the rabbi. So they say to the kid, let's go to the rabbi. And he says to him, what do you mean? When you go to a rabbi, what's a rabbi? The rabbi's a joke. What do you mean the rabbi's a joke? Well, you know, spent the last 15 years demonstrating how he's an idiot and he's ignorant, or the gedolim are off base, and you've been critical about how they don't know what's going on in the world. So now, why would you expect that I would want to be responsive to anything that they would say? And at that point, is the battle is lost. There's nobody to go to. Parents can do this with one another. If children see that the other parent is dismissed or that their opinion is not valued, so when you need that authority, it's not there because you destroyed it. So l'hazik delim alaktanim can also mean that the responsibility of the adult generation is to see to it that the ketanim have a respect for the gedolim. That you haven't torn everybody down so that when the time comes that you need to be able to appeal to their authority, there is no reverence, there's no awe, there's no deference, there's no respect, because over time you've eroded it. It's really, unfortunately, a pretty common kind of thing. One of the popular pastimes is either dismissing another parent's authority or their understanding, or to dismiss the respectability or the scholarship or the moral authority of the rabbi, and certainly of the gedolei Torah. I mean, it's not. Everybody's a maven. And then when you need it, it's gone. It's not there. And so that's just another reading of that same chazal. One of the streets over here is the fact that a kohen is prohibited from not only coming in contact, physical contact with a dead body, but even being in the same room as a corpse or any part of a corpse.
Even the same house, isn't that true?
Well, it could be. It depends on in most cases it would be in the same building, because tumah is conducted in ways which make it very difficult to contain. So there are circumstances that do contain it. Most homes are not built so to conform to those halachic standards. So tumah flows from one room to the next.
What about going to a hospital?
So that's a big problem. Big problem for a kohen.
Driving under this bridge.
We had for a short time, we had a Rosh Kollel here who was a kohen before Rabbi Sendrova came. And he would not drive under the bridge of St. Joe's, because
isn't he in oil? Isn't his car in oil?
Even though he was in oil, yeah. So I mean, I'm not sure about exactly how this works, but there are problems with airplanes that fly over cemeteries.
Israel, big time, big problems.
Anyway, an airplane that flies over a cemetery is a problem. Yeah. Anyway, so it's not only the fact that, you know, the problem with the hospital is not only the fact there might be a Jewish corpse there. The problem is there might even be an organ. You know, that they take. They amputate a limb. It has the same thing. It could be metame. So, but our concern over here is that it would seem to be a contradiction, because on the one hand, one of the greatest mitzvos of all is preparing the dead for burial. It's called a chesed shalem. It's called a true act of loving kindness. Mm. Because no one ever gets, you know, you can't expect the person you're doing it for to pay you back. Mm. So and even though there are many kindnesses that we perform which are very sincere, but there's always an element of it that whatever we give comes around. So in one way or another, there's at least a possibility that it will be recognized, it will be repaid. But here there's no way it's going to be repaid. There's absolutely no question about the fact that it is a great mitzvah. They say that, I believe it's a Gemara, that one of the sages was questioned by, I suspect, a Roman, who said to him, isn't your God a Kohen? Which is to say that God has to represent the highest level of priesthood. So he said, yes. So he said, well, God is the one who buried Moses. Moshe Rabbeinu had no one to take care of. God did it. So in what stream did God immerse himself to remove the tumor?
These Romans were always thinking of questions like this.
If you want to know why the Roman Empire went under, just listen to their questions. Okay, so, but the point is that it is a great mitzvah. And we're told, the Torah begins with Gemilas Chasadim, concludes with Gemilas Chasadim, begins with Gemilas Chasadim because God crafted clothes to cover the nakedness of Adam and Chava, even though they became naked by defying him. And nonetheless, he was charitable to them. And it concludes with Gemilas Chasadim because it concludes with the burial of Moshe. So God begins the Torah with an act of loving kindness and ends the Torah with an act of loving kindness. So how is it? I mean, our common understanding of Tumah is that Tumah is not a good thing. So how is it that in the course of doing a supreme act of goodness, a great mitzvah, did you become tummy? So there's no question about the fact that one of the things that's questioned is by the fact that Tumah has many points of reference, and that there are some forms of Tumah which represent a state of ritual compromise which is profound, and that there are other gradations of that which represent the form of ritual containment or restriction which is not so profound. Here, I think it's important to find that one of those gradations of Tumah is not the immersion in the forces of darkness, which one legitimate state of Tumah would represent, but a state of restriction which is more like kind of retreat, which is to suggest to a person there something has happened which renders you tummy. Now, when the Torah says this renders you tummy, the Torah is saying to you, don't go forward until you've integrated the experience. Don't go any further until you've reflected on what's happened over here. So it's saying to you, whether it's the temple service, eating korbanos, eating truma, davening, learning Torah, you need to put your life on pause for a little bit. Think. Integrate. Regroup. A certain sense of time of integration. So there are, again, more and less serious such times of reflection. For example, intimacy, physical intimacy with a woman, render somebody tummy for a day. The prophet Ezra decreed that a person who's been intimate should not daven or learn Torah without first immersing themselves in a mikveh. That decree did not last very long, because sages discerned that it was a decree which was not working for the masses. It was something that the majority of the nation was not, they weren't doing it. So it was rescinded because it wasn't working. Even though it was rescinded, it was not to say that the achievement that it represented was a mistake. It was just, there was a recognition that there were a lot of people who weren't going to do it. So, and as much as it was a decree, and the decree was dependent on whether or not it was going to achieve its result, the sages abrogated the decree. Now, one of the things that that's saying is, this is not an insignificant experience. It's an experience in which the ramifications of the experience are manifold. Before you approach an act of intimacy with God, which Torah represents and which davening represents, you just were in a different place. Now, you know, how far is one place from the next? That distance is significant. In some instances, one becomes a commentary on the other. So there's a state of tumah, and the state of tumah says to a person, stop and think, stop and integrate, stop and reflect. Don't just move on as though nothing happened. You've been engaged in being kind to a deceased person. That confrontation with mortality, when the person does a tara, he's not doing something to an object. It is a meeting with one's own mortality. Just as much as it's an act of kindness, there is a recognition of mortality. People are human. That person that I'm caring for right now, in every which way, is exactly like I am. There's just one thing missing, that he does not have a spark of life. So what does that mean? How does it inform me? How does it inspire me? How do I move forward from this moment mindful of my mortality? How am I not depressed by it? Or how should I be moved by it? Whatever it is, it is an important experience. And in this case, Tuma, by imposing a pause, is not the same category of tuma as someone who is immersed in a place of evil. This is a tuma from which people grow. Intimacy is a tuma from which people can grow. There are kinds of tuma which are very much like the challenges that we face in life, which are rather unpleasant. You know, ask a kid how much they enjoy going to school. It's not fun, but at some point they understand that the only way that they've reached a place where they can be fulfilled in life and achieve things in life is only because they learned once that 2 and 2 is 4. So as unpopular or as painful as homework and going to school were, the only way to reach a state of tahara is sometimes, maybe always, by going through the woods, going through the forest. It's not unlike, in a certain sense, the fact that one of the repercussions of the man's first sin is that women give birth in pain and men have to struggle with the ground to evoke. So there is this kind of tuma, which is a tuma that generates, being in a state of tuma is not a bad thing. It's a time of, the Torah is saying, stop. Put your life on pause for a little bit. Don't just go and rush right back into life. I saw a beautiful commentary. I don't know who the author is, but he quotes the Sfas Emes. No, it quotes Reb Tzadik HaKayim. It quotes Reb Tzadik. That Reb Tzadik says, that on Shavuos, it's a time of judgment. Sukkot is a time of judgment in terms of the rainfall of the year. Shavuos is a time of judgment for the fruit of the tree. But he says the offering which is brought is not fruit. You do bring Bikurim, mm-hmm. You bring the first fruit. But the offering which you bring in the Mishkan and Beit HaMikdash is these two breads, which are actually chametz. It's the only time that you have chametz, but it's made out of wheat. Pesach you start out with barley, and that's the Omer, and then it ends up with Shavuos. So Pesach you judged for Tefuah, and Shavuos you judge for grain. So Tzadik says that grain and fruit represent two extremes. Fruit, you pick it off the tree and you eat it. Grain, you gotta plow the ground, fertilize the ground, plant, nourish the soil with water, cut it, thresh it, grind it, knead it, bake it. He said there are two extremes. He said fruit represents the way the entire world was supposed to be for Adam before he sinned. Mm-hmm. Everything was supposed to be ready. And it's like you could walk over and there was a tree of Danishes. Indeed, everything was there. Everything grew. You didn't have to do anything. It's just that the world was eager to offer itself to Adam because Adam and Eve were the ones who were going to be the pyramid. They were the ones through whom the vegetation that fed on the minerals of the ground were elevated to something that grows, and then something that grows was picked by Adam and he ate it, and then Adam would serve God with that energy, and all of that, the entire creation was elevated through Adam. So fruit represents that dimension of creation, which is the way the world is supposed to be, the entire world is supposed to be, every aspect of it was supposed to be for man when he's serving God. Grain represents the fallen world, the world that Adam corrupted. If you want to access the holiness of the world, if you want to reach Kiddush in the world, it's not going to be easy. You got to, just like the physical world, you got to plow and you got to thresh and you got to grind it and you got to bake it. That's really how most of our spiritual world goes. We can't access Kedusha easily. Holiness is you got to go into your neshama, you got to plow your neshama, you got to do, it's a lot of work. So you have these two extremes. You have the world of the way it's supposed to be for man when man is at his highest place, and you have the world as it is when man is descended to a nasty place. So in Shavuos, when we receive the Torah, we have the tools to access that highest level. The only way to get there is by addressing those. So you have this. You're judged for the fruit. In other words, the fruit of the world. Whether or not, or to what extent, we are closer to that ideal is dependent on how we use the gift of Torah. These two breads, which are actually chometz, represent, I think, two things. It represents at once a recognition of what a compromised world has forced upon man. Because those two breads didn't get there easily. They had to go through that whole process. And at the same time, speaks to the fact that in recognizing that that's what we're dealing with, that we're supposed to live in such a way so as to to return grain to their original state. And the comment of our sages is that in the Vasi Lavai, that people will pick, they'll pick bread off the trees finished. Mm-hmm. Won't have to go through the whole thing. Which is to say that even grain will also become. There's a comment that the fruit from which Adam ate was chita. That it was wheat. In our experience, is not a fruit, but when Adam ate from it, it was fruit. Anyway, now let's take the ultimate. The ultimate readiness to be open to prophecy was Moshe Rabbeinu. Right? Moshe Rabbeinu was someone whose entire life was really dedicated to being the conduit through which God's will would become manifest to man. That availability, Moshe Rabbeinu himself reasoned, demanded that he give up being intimate with his wife, because being intimate with his wife meant that he would become tummy for a day. Becoming tummy for a day meant that there would be one day in which he would not be available for that intimacy with God that would allow for the Torah to be coming to the world. So it could be that the Torah would come into the world a day later, but that would mean that the world was without that Torah for a day. So Moshe Rabbeinu separated. He was no longer intimate with his wife. It was an act. He committed himself that he would always be available. Now that
caused his wife to be committed as well.
But she was not pleased with that. She wasn't committed, but she wasn't pleased.
Didn't he not fulfill Purim?
He probably didn't. Yeah, he only had two sons, right?
So he reasoned that the need for bringing Torah into the world was greater than Purim.
Yes, that was his conclusion, and it was the conclusion with which God agreed. So, but God never agreed that was a standard. So there's no one else who is the Kohen HaGadol is not allowed to do the service unless he's married, for which reason he would marry another woman, just so that in case his wife died, that he would not be disqualified from the service. So there is no way there is no other instance other than Moshe Rabbeinu is the exception to the rule. But he was an exception to the rule for a very important reason, because he had to be available. The availability of a coin to do the service requires the coin not to come in contact with Tumah. He is that particular officiant whose job it is to be available for the service. So he's not to come in contact with Tumah. To the extent that life is life, he would not be completely out of that entire experience, because there's a mitzvah for the kohen to be mitame to his parents, his siblings, his wife, and or his children. You know, he wouldn't be completely without the experience. But I think one of the very crucial disservices that our culture's conditioning has done has been to foster the attitude that meaningful things can happen without meaningful input. That's one of the casualties of technology. We think that there's a shortcut to everything, and that there's a shortcut to spirituality, and that there's a shortcut to character. There are no shortcuts. You can't have instantaneous character without going through all the challenges that shape character. You have to be tested. You have to go through the crucible in order to develop the characteristics. The fact that you sit in your sofa and think about how heroic you would be does not change the fact that you're a couch potato. And the people who are heroic are the people who actually do heroic things. So there's no way that you can put Torah on some tape and then put it underneath your pillow and wake up a Torah scholar.
So the counting of the Omer, we have this whole thing that we transform ourselves in 49 days. You know, and every day we have a another thing, like in well, the I days think that, comes and goes.
I think there's a recognition that you transform yourself by tiny little increments, and that if you put together 49 tiny little increments, that it's a that there's a fist of difference between what you were on Pesach and what you are on Shavuos. I have to assume that the generation of Moshe Rabbeinu being exposed to all kinds of really extraordinary kinds of hashpois, revelations and whatnot, that the difference between who they were when they left Egypt to who they were when they stood at Sinai was one of great magnitude. But I don't think that the expectation is that we can make that kind of quantum leap that they did.
Not all tumor is bad.
Wait, that's good.